glad to keep that open in front of you, please. I was watching telly earlier this week, and there was a sketch show on. It was a rerun from an earlier one, actually. You may have come across it, The Mitchell and Webb Experience. It's a standard kind of TV sketch show, if you've not seen it, but one particular sketch concerned a crime-fighting superhero duo known as Angel Summoner and BMX Bandit. And say they fight crime using their special powers. BMX Bandit has the special power of being able to use his BMX skills to fight crime, whereas Angel Summoner can summon hordes of angels at will. Now, in this particular sketch, a bank is being robbed, and the robbers are inside with hostages, and they're armed, and BMX Bandit and Angel Summoner are considering how to fight this crime. So BMX Bandit says, I tell you what, I'll ride through up this ramp, crash through the window, knocking out the first of the guards there. I'll then pop a wheelie, disarming the second guard, and do a back axle 720 to knock the rest out. Meanwhile, Angel Summoner, you nip in round the back, untie the prisoners, and we'll all escape. And Angel Summoner says, well, we could do that, but why don't I just summon a horde of angels to sort it out? So they summon a horde of angels, and the sketch kind of cuts forward to the end, where Angels, some of them are looking quite pleased with themselves, but BMX Bandit is less happy. And he pauses for a moment and says, you know, I know at the end of the day it's all about the result, but I can't help but feel that your ability to summon angels at will is making my BMX skills look rather redundant in this partnership. And that's pretty much where it finishes. But the reason I tell that, it's not hugely relevant, but it did kind of bring to mind a couple of points from today's story. First of all, you may remember from the other account of when Jesus is arrested, in Matthew's account, in fact, that Jesus says to Peter, as he gets his sword out, look, stop, don't you know that I could ask God and he'd send me hordes of angels to sort these things out? But he doesn't do that. Actually, what we see in Christ is a decision not to avoid what's happening. But it also made me wonder how many times the disciples felt a bit like BMX Bandit, looking at what Jesus could do, the amazing things he was capable of, and feeling a little bit sort of second rate. Of course, that partnership was in no way an equal partnership, and in no way are we equal partners with Christ. We depend utterly on him for our salvation. We depend utterly on God for our guidance. It's never supposed to be an equal partnership. And yet in this relationship, Christ does ask us to work for him, to be partners with him in the gospel. As he has now left earth physically, it is us who are his ambassadors, we who take the message, we who are his representatives and who live for him. In this passage today, we're going to see how Christ must be fully relied upon. For the things that we can't do, that he is fully in control, that throughout the story, he knows what is happening, it's part of a plan. But we'll also see how the disciples don't quite get their part of this plan yet, and how in their behavior, they do let Christ down time and time again. And we can see how we could learn from that and become the kind of disciples that Christ wants us to be. See, for the last few weeks, things have changed. For 3 years, the disciples have been going around Israel with the man of the moment, Jesus, the talk of the nation. They've seen some amazing healings and miracles. They've heard some great teaching. They've seen him take on the authorities and win those arguments too. They've been his closest friends. At times, they've even tried to vet who comes to see him and who doesn't. They've been sent out by Christ and have themselves done amazing things and seen some great mission work happening. But recently, things have started to change. Jesus has stopped walking around Israel and is now going towards Jerusalem, where he arrived for us a few weeks ago. And on the way to Jerusalem, he's been telling his disciples that where it was easy before, it's going to change. I'm going to be offered up to the chief priests. I'll be arrested. I'll suffer and die. And the disciples are struggling to understand why this must happen. He said to them that it's not just he who's going to face these kinds of persecutions, although mostly it's him. In the story 2 weeks ago, we saw how he warned them that Satan was asking to test them. He'd warned them that although in previous missions that they'd done, it had been straightforward, they'd lacked nothing, actually now they need to be prepared. He'd even used the metaphor of a sword to illustrate just how oppressive their opposition is now going to be and how prepared they need to be. He said to them that this is about what was always planned. It was prophesied. He said to them, you know the one about being numbered with the transgressors? That's me. It's fulfilled in me. And I have to go up and die. But you guys are numbered with me. You can't do what I do. But you will face opposition and persecution too. And it's written. It's there. It's in the plan. It was always going to happen. And for good measure, he throws in a few more as well. One of you will betray me. And even tells Judas, yes, it's you. To Peter, he says, far from being the man who's going to stand by me, you deny me. You'll deny me three times and be restored afterwards. He knows what's going to happen. And it's important that the disciples knew that he knew what was going to happen, because otherwise what's about to happen will throw them completely. And there would be a danger they would fall away. And it's important for us too to realize that Christ is fully in control, that God is in charge of our lives. Whatever is happening, we can rely on that. It's no accident he's explaining these things. He is steeling the disciples for what's to come. Because you see, if you didn't know the outcome, if you didn't know the answer, this passage today looks like failure. It breaks down into four sections. First of all, you have the episode when Jesus is praying. And yet his close disciples, rather than praying with him as they've been asked to, just fall asleep, exhausted through sorrow. In the next section, Jesus is arrested by the chief priests and their allies. It seems that they've won. They've been trying to arrest him. They've been plotting for ages, and they finally, it seems, got their way. Peter, arguably the closest disciple, denies him, he even knows him, three times. His closest friends deserting him. And we finish up with Jesus in the hands of the Roman guards being mocked and beaten. You're a prophet, are you? Well, prophesy, who's hit you now? He looks to have lost. But we know better. A closer look reveals just how in control Jesus is of this situation. Look at Gethsemane again. It's verses 39 through to 45. He's gone up the Mount of Olives. As usual, it's a habit for him. He goes to the Mount of Olives to pray regularly. He's got there again with the closest of his disciples. He said, pray, you will not fall into temptation. He's gone a bit further, and he has started to wrestle in prayer. We thought about this a bit earlier as well. Now, other people, other Christians, have faced death calmly, willingly, knowing that it's part of God's plan. Why is Jesus not doing that here? Why is there so much anguish? Because we understand that it's not just the physical pain. It's not just the humiliation. It's not just the death that he will suffer, and the betrayal and rejection and desertion. The fact is that Jesus will be separated from his Father, something we'll look at in more detail in future weeks. It's the kind of pain that we cannot really identify with exactly. We are not the Son of God. We cannot ever really understand just what it must mean, but we can get an idea by looking at this. Jesus knows exactly what this means, exactly how much he will suffer. And he cries to God, is there any other way? Can this be avoided? Is there an alternative, another method by which people can be saved, by which the world can be won? And yet, not my will, but yours. What you want, we will do. This is remarkable. And you can probably say that by and large, the battle was won here as much as anywhere else. At this point, Jesus makes that decision to be submissive to his Father's will, and he will, from this point on, go through. He will be in full control of events that happen next because he has decided, he has prayed, and he has made up his mind, and he knows what it is he has to do, and he will go and do it. I'll just take you very quickly to Hebrews chapter 5. You don't have to turn to this. It says this. During the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with loud cries and tears to the one who could save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverent submission. Although he was a son, he learned obedience from what he suffered, and once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him, you and me, if we obey him. Jesus Christ, God himself, became submissive to his Father. And because of that submission, and because of that obedience, we are here today. So he moves on then. Waking up his disciples, they move on to another part of the Mount of Olives. The disciples are still scared, they're tired. They have misunderstood Jesus' earlier words about a sword, had a whip round and actually come up with a couple of swords and have strapped them on and are now wandering around with Christ, wondering what's going to happen next. They meet from the other direction coming up the hill, another armed mob, this time led by the chief priests, with Roman guards, we find out elsewhere as well, trained fighters. The two meet in the middle. Judas, formerly one of the 12, comes up and blatantly betrays Christ in front of everyone else. Peter whips out that sword and starts swinging, cutting off the ear. Now, I don't know what you like in terms of mob psychology, but you probably recognize this kind of situation normally kicks off quite badly. People are scared, people are nervous, and someone started fighting. Such is the control of Christ over the situation that with a word, he stops it. He is a central figure here. Far from being the criminal who is going to be arrested and dragged away, he is in control. Stop. Enough of this. He even reaches out and heals the injured man. Yes, they could have got him any time. Day by day, I'm in the temple and you didn't lay a hand on me. Now you're here. Well, I'm going to go with you. Not because you're stronger, not because I've lost, none of those things, but this is the plan. This is your hour, he says to them. Not, I've had a go, but you've won, this is not, you've now got your day, but this is your appointed time. This is where you fulfill your part of the plan. This is the part of God's plan that you fulfill, even though you're against me. It all comes together. We move on to the third part, the temple courtyards. Peter, he has stuck with Christ, he's followed at a distance, he's gone in and he's found himself a place by the fire. And what seems to happen is, three times in a row, he denies that he even knows Jesus. Well, that is what happens. Three times he denies he even knows Christ. But we think back. Jesus has already said to Peter, you're going to deny me. Do you know what else? You're going to deny me three times, precisely. Do you know what else? When you finish doing that, the cock's going to crow. Oh, and you know what else? I pray that you won't lose your faith. You won't lose your faith, and something else, you'll be restored afterwards. Jesus knows exactly what's going to happen. And even in the middle of his arrest, surrounded by the people who are accusing him, arguing over his future, he can stop as the cock crows and look over and single Peter out. He knows what is happening. He is fully in control. And that, of course, makes a very big irony of the next section where the guards mock him. Prophet, are you? Prophesy this. Because we've just seen what an amazing prophet he is. I wonder if he was tempted to answer their question. Would have made quite a point. But he doesn't. He is there in submission to his Father's will. At every stage, Christ is in control. He is fulfilling the plans his Father has for him. And because of that, we're here today. We had to look on at this in awe as disciples. He's in a battle here, which the people then couldn't really see, the spiritual side they couldn't really understand. None of us could do this. Yes, there are times when we can look at Christ and see a great example in him, the way he prays, the way he loves people, the way he deals in situations. Many times you can see him as an example to us, but many other times we just have to look on as the Son of God rescues us and does things that we could never do. I've mentioned this before, but a little while ago, me and Sarah were out at a meal with some friends, and the conversation had come around to religion, and they were describing themselves as spiritual people. At one point, the lady said, we see Jesus as a great moral teacher, but we can't have anything to do with this he was God thing. Now, even if you were to take away all the miracles and resurrections and virgin births and all sorts of things, you cannot read what Jesus says as anything like just a great moral teacher. He is not just an example to us, although he is that as well. So we can't see this story today as a moral story about how Jesus was not downcast when his friends fell asleep, how he was non-violent when he was arrested, how he forgave someone who denied him, or how he bravely put up with persecution even though it was unjust. All those things are true, of course, and can be useful. But if you want that kind of story, we may as well watch Gandhi. We'll get it from that. This is about who Christ is. and we have to look and wonder. If then we're going to learn from this, I think we need to look very carefully at what the disciples did, how they responded, and how they should have responded, what Jesus told them to expect, what Jesus told them to do. Because that's where we are in this story, disciples of Christ, often making the same mistakes. Let's go back to the beginning, 39 to 46 again. So Jesus is praying, and we know why he's praying. We know what comes out of that prayer. But the disciples just fall asleep. Twice Jesus says to them, pray that you will not fall into temptation. In fact, if we read the other accounts of this passage in other Gospels, we find that Luke's contracted it. It happens several times. He came back, comes back, wakes them up. Pray that you won't fall into temptation. They fall asleep again. And he comes back, has to wake them up again. What is he asking them to pray against? What is a temptation? To fall asleep? No, of course not. That's just a completely circular argument. He's asking them here, in the light of what you've heard before, knowing that you're about to face persecution, knowing that you must steel yourself for difficult times ahead, pray that you will not fall into temptation. This is temptation in the widest context, not something about what you eat or drink or sexual or financial or anything like that, anything nice and specific that we can hide behind and say, I don't do that, I don't fall into temptation. This is a temptation to deny, a temptation to move away, to disassociate ourselves with Christ, to not honour him, to not obey him, to not glorify him. That's a temptation that we must pray against. And it's ongoing. It's every single day of every single week of every single year. And it's hard. Because we still sin so much and find it so hard to resist that. And it's the hardest times when we need to pray the hardest. Now, I don't know about you, but I often take that to mean when times are hard, I will start to pray, i.e. something's gone wrong at work, so I pray to get it right. There's an illness in the family, so I pray about that. Or someone we know is having a hard time. Well, yes, that's true, and we need to do that, certainly. But I think what is being said here is that when we recognize the times ahead are going to be hard, not in the sense of a personal assault, but in the sense of maintaining our walk with Christ, when we see times ahead are going to be hard, that is when we need to pray the hardest. He's talking here about preemptive prayer. Get your prayer in first. Before the temptation even comes along, you know the kind of things we're going to face. But instead, because of their sorrow, we're told, they fall asleep, exhausted. Now, of course, what was going to happen wasn't pleasant, but they'd had enough warnings it was going to happen. Yes, they'll be upset about what they're going to see. But clearly this has taken up all of their time, all of their thinking, and they are exhausted from sorrow and fall asleep when they should have been praying with Christ about the hard times ahead, because they will face them too. So Jesus' rebuke is not petulant. He's not just cross that they fell asleep and he didn't. Look, guys, he's saying, you've got to pray against temptation because it's going to come, and you will fall if you don't. Because Satan, as we know, has asked to sift these guys, as he does us too. We know that he is against anything we try and do as a church, as a body of Christ. He will try and mess up our church meetings and our church relationships. He'll try and get involved with what the elders are doing. He'll be involved in our marriages, involved in our relationship with our kids, with our friends, with our work colleagues. He'll try and push all the buttons with financial issues. He'll do whatever he can to upset us. Anything he can to move the church of God away from God. And we must be ready for it. And praying against that temptation before it even arises. We know it's coming. Without prayer, we will rationalize or we'll just not care. I'm not suggesting, by the way, if you pray, you will not sin. We still have to make a choice. What we are doing is we are preparing ourselves for it. But these disciples weren't. And so when they went down the Mount of Olives and the mob comes against them, their reaction is not to live as Christ would live. When did Christ ever pull a sword on somebody? But instead they do. They react violently, the way they know how. Notice, by the way, the disciples are not cowards. They were happy to take on the authorities, happy to take on the Roman soldiers. And then they lost, and they knew they would. But they do it. These aren't cowardly people. But they weren't prepared in the way that Christians should be prepared. That's why Jesus both tells them off and even goes as far as to heal the person who's been injured. This is not the way that we do it. This is not what the disciples of Christ, the church of Christ, the body of Christ, behaves like. The Bible doesn't tell us, but I wonder how many of the mob who came up the hill were so amazed by what they saw Christ do. The healing, the words, the going with them, that perhaps later they too became disciples. We don't know. I also wonder how many of those people who came up the hill saw Peter draw his sword and thought, yes, they're right. Just another crazy religious nut with a little band of followers, just like the rest of them. See what they're like the rest of them. No real difference. I do wonder how many times I've said or done things that have actually distracted people from Christ or made them think, you're a Christian, you're no different. Because I wasn't prepared. I wasn't living as a disciple. And I should have known better. And then Peter, of course. Perhaps overconfident. Excuse me. I'll never let you down. Certainly underprepared, certainly lacking prayer. What was he expecting to happen when he went into the courtyard? What was he there for? Again, we don't really know. Was he looking for an opportunity to sort of bust Jesus out of his imprisonment? Was he just wanting to see what was going to happen? We don't really know. But we do know that he sat down there and the red mist had sort of evaporated again. And as they sit round the fire, a servant girl says, you were with him, weren't you? Why did he deny that? Perhaps he was now scared again. Perhaps he had realized that he couldn't stop events and didn't want to be connected. Perhaps he was just thinking, I'm here to do a job. I'm here to help Jesus out. I won't help him if they know I'm a Christian. If I know I'm a disciple, so it's just a servant girl. No, not me, mate. Made a mistake. We can rationalize things so easily, can't we, like that? It doesn't matter this one little thing. It's for a greater good. But suddenly he's committed. And next time, of course, it's easier to lie. Just as for us, if we sin the once, sometimes the next time is easier. And by the time the third person comes along, he's denying he knows Christ with oaths, with curses, with foul language. He's made his choice there. And the cock crows. Now, I don't think I've ever denied Christ as directly as that. Most of you, I imagine, will be in the same position, if not all. Then again, I've never been in a position where I feared for my life if I didn't deny Christ, so perhaps I shouldn't be quite so smug about that. I do know that if I did, I would feel awful. And I can completely feel why Peter would respond by that bitter weeping that we read here. Never denied Christ that way, but I think I've denied Christ in lots of other ways. And I guess we all do, don't we? In what we say, in what we do. Perhaps not realizing fundamentally that in this world we're not here to pay off our mortgages and raise our kids primarily. We are here as witnesses, ambassadors for Christ, disciples. But this world will pass. And the people that we are working with day in, day out, if they're going to be in a new creation with us, need to hear about Christ. But such is our love affair with the world, such is our lack of prayer, where it's important we don't take those key, vital opportunities. We're not prepared. Time's up. I'm sure there are many examples, many areas we can think about where we should and shouldn't say things, where we have denied Christ in our actions and words, and perhaps home group would be a good time to think those through more carefully. But I want to finish on this. Peter, despite this dreadful denial, was restored. Restored by Christ, read in other Gospels. We will also face situations, we will also fail. We also live in a world where it's hard to keep ourselves focused and targeted, where we struggle to pray even though we know we should. We'll be provoked, are betrayed, we'll fail, we'll be persecuted, mocked. But we're disciples of Christ, the King, who followed God's plan through perfectly. And as disciples of Christ, we must therefore do as he asks, pray that we'll not fall into temptation, work as disciples of Christ, live to his glory in everything that we do, because we are his.